This is Ozarks at Large for Thursday, January 19th, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
And I'm Iti Agnihotri Matholkar. In a moment on Ozarks, what is to be done with the remnants of the mostly flooded city of Montanay in Benton County? Demolition of the last edifices has been discussed, but not everybody wants to see the structures destroyed.
And two museums consider other bits of our past. In Rogers, Southern stereotypes and comic strips are examined, while in Fort Smith, the Clayton House has a series of discussions on the city and the region's past.
And our regular Thursday guests, Michael Tilley from thecitywire.com and Jody Besnoska from Walton Arts Center are here.
SONA, the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas, continues its inaugural season Saturday at Walton Arts Center in Fayetteville. Featuring international pianist Sergei Babayan, SONA will present two classical masterworks, Symphony No. 5 in D minor by Shostakovich and Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto No. 3 in D minior. Tickets are available at 443-5600 or waltonartcenter.org.
Most of Montanay, an early 1900s summer resort built in a spring-fed forested valley southeast of Rogers, now lies submerged beneath Beaver Reservoir. The few architectural relics along the lakeshore that remain have been heavily vandalized in recent years and pose a danger to the public. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, which owns the property, held a public meeting late last year to consider demolition. Since then, a concerted effort has been forming to preserve Montanay's legacy. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich reports.
Montanay, said to be a combination of Spanish and Omaha Indian words, means mountain water. It was named by William Hope Coyne Carvey, lawyer, silver speculator, and political philosopher who staked a 320-acre claim on a portion of the artesian spring saturated hamlet known as Silver Spring, southeast of Rogers. By the 1920s, he had turned a modest farm village and local summer retreat into a luxury resort with three hotels, an indoor swimming pool, tennis court, outdoor amphitheater, and a private railroad spur connected to the St. Louis and San Francisco Railway. Montanay's history has been beautifully chronicled in a pictorial book authored by Ellen Lord, then director of Rogers Historical Museum. Gabe Land now serves as museum director. And along with Alan Lord, now director of the Shiloh Museum of Ozark History, have long advocated for preserving what's left of historic Montanay.
It was one of the most popular resorts in Arkansas. At the time, it was thriving in the early 1900s. And it's also associated with William H. Coyne Harvey, who's an individual not just of statewide historical significance, but actually of national significance. He was a noted leader in the Free Silver Movement and was very well known, best-selling author at the time when he came to Northwest Arkansas, something of a celebrity at that time.
The Free Silver Movement, by the way, traces back to an 1873 Act of Congress which excluded the silver dollar from common currency. Advocates seeking to undo the law included silver mine operators like William Coyne Harvey, hence his nickname, as well as farmers and debtors who believed silver would cure a then-ailing economy.
So that's certainly part of it. And also, it certainly has some architectural and engineering significance. The concrete tower that's the most visible remnant of the resort of Montanay was part of a larger hotel. Most of the rest of the structure was log, but that concrete tower is one of the early examples of reinforced concrete construction in Arkansas, so it has some architectural and engineering significance, too.
The tower was once part of Montanay's magnificent complex of log, limestone, and concrete structures, either torn down or submerged in Beaver Lake.
So there's nothing that the City of Rogers Historical Museum, which is what we are, a part of the city, can directly do there. You know, we couldn't lease it from the Corps to manage it. And the reality is that the Corps doesn't have the funds to do the preservation project or to maintain it as a historic site with a walking trail. And the Corps also cannot accept third-party funds. So we really are going to have to find some entity, either perhaps the county, though they certainly have not seriously considered that yet, or a 501c3 nonprofit that would lease the site and that way, private funds could be raised for its preservation and to continue to maintain it.
Gabe Land says the Arkansas Archaeological Survey, Arkansas Historical Association, Benton County Preservation Commission, Historic Preservation Alliance of Arkansas, along with citizens and businesses, are coming forward to help.
The first thing that we really hoped might happen would be that perhaps it could be part of a state park, that perhaps it could be brought in as just a small 5-acre walking trail site under the management of Hobbs State Park. But unfortunately, state parks has become overextended over the years, and they have a moratorium on accepting any more responsibilities, and it's going to be a long time before they'll be looking toward that. So that's not an option. But now knowing that, the next step we want to take is to do a fundraising feasibility study to see whether or not the funds can be raised for the preservation and the sustainability of the site, because we do not want to go through the process, the lengthy and difficult process of forming a 501c3 organization until we have a feasibility study that shows us that there is broad public support and that the money will be available going forward.
Fundraising in a down economy is hard enough. Imagine trying to raise money and attention for a historic site mostly buried in water. Just the feasibility studies estimated to cost $10,000.
And we have got the very kind agreement of the Rogers Lowell Chamber of Commerce to channel funds for the feasibility study through them, so that if we can find a number of someone who are willing to put some money toward that, we would have a way for their donations to be tax exempt for that.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers Beaver Lake office called a public meeting to discuss the fate of Montanay last November, especially the large concrete and stone tower and fireplace, part of the large Oklahoma Row Log Hotel, listed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1992. Sean Harper is Operations Project Manager for Beaver Lake Army Corps District.
I guess there were several incidents this particular summer that just brought to light continuing to just leave things as they are really wasn't an acceptable situation for us. So there was one particular incident where one gentleman got stuck in the chimney, and the city of Rogers had to come out with a fire truck and arrange different types of things to try to get the gentleman out. And so it just kind of illuminated the idea that, well, you know, just from a public safety perspective, we probably really need to do something different.
A locked chain link fence was erected around the old tower to protect it and the public. Harper said that neighbors who live adjacent to Montanay reported the barrier initially helped, but has since been damaged and breached. So the Corps is actively seeking partners to help solve the problem, including a public entity like the county or city, to lease the land to maintain and operate the historic site into perpetuity.
If there's a general consensus that there's valid, considerable organization behind preserving it, and it looks like that on the horizon there's an actual opportunity to do that, then that's going to weigh heavily into the Corps' decision.
Sean Harper says the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has several rangers who monitor cultural sites along Beaver Lake's 500 miles of shoreline, and no money to fix up or demolish what's left of Montanay. But it did set aside money to hire two experts who will come here in the coming weeks from the Corps' Preservation of Historic Buildings and Structures Office based in Seattle. And Chris Page, archaeologist with the Little Rock District Corps of Engineers, is confident the Corps' Seattle preservation experts will help to clarify things.
So they will be used, and they will come down and do the documentation required for the preservation option. And then, if needed, do the documentation for the mitigation if we do decide to go the demolition route. And that's where we would coordinate with the State Historic Preservation, other historic agencies, to determine what level of mitigation would be required if we did need to tear down Oklahoma Row or the concrete tower, because that is the biggest safety issue out there.
And if demolished, visitors to Matane could expect a lakeshore wilderness, perhaps a few hiking trails, maybe some signage interpreting what was once there. But on occasion, given extended drought, we can expect the once grand bridge, stairways, foundations, and even the magnificent hand-cut stone amphitheater of Matane to emerge from the depths of Beaver Lake onto the Ozarks mountain landscape. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
If you'd like to visit historic Matane, you can turn east off Highway 71 and South Rogers onto Arkansas 94, then drive down the mountain until the road ends at the lake. With me on the phone now from his office, relatively new office in Fort Smith, is Michael Tilley, who is the editor, publisher, and president of thecitywire.com. How are you on this Thursday?
I am well. It's a great, great, crispy morning, this cool, crispy morning today.
At the top of the local wire on thecitywire.com today, a not surprising but still not pleasant news about another Whirlpool vendor that is going to close up shop and leave Fort Smith, this one, Huntington Foam.
Yes, Huntington Foam, they've been here not a long time, but as you said, we hate to see anyone go, but we knew this was coming. Huntington Foam, they produce a lot of this. It's not just, you know, the foam you get in the when you order something from Amazon or whatever. It's a specialized type product that they wrap around refrigerators and trash compactors as they ship out. But I guess if you're looking for any good news in this, they only employ around 14 now, but at one time they employed just short of 70. So, and as Whirlpool production declined, obviously their employment declined, but they'll probably be out of here May or June, and they're moving most of that production, again, not surprisingly, to their plant in Mexico, Ramos Arizpe plant, which is where Whirlpool has its plant that's producing most of the product that used to be produced in Fort Smith.
And when the announcement was made that Whirlpool by the middle of this year would pretty much be gone, there were expected to be some small dominoes that would follow.
Right, and we'd asked Gregory Hamilton, he's a senior economic researcher at the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, to produce an impact, and he estimated, around 475 jobs would be lost from direct jobs would be lost from vendors in this area to Whirlpool, and about 80 jobs outside the Fort Smith region related to vendors, and you know those could be packaging folks, ad production, that kind of thing, accounting, some back-end operations. But, the trickle-down, we had one emailer send a response to the story and said, let the trickle-down begin. So I think this is what's happening. Although, if you remember, Fortis Plastics announced they were closing, and they announced several days before Whirlpool announced they were leaving.
Is there any way to replace these positions, these jobs?
No, sir. I talked to Mr. McLaughlin, the president of Huntington Foam. They're based in Gannett, Pennsylvania. And he said, you know, the problem is this was such a specialty product they were doing for Whirlpool that you just, you know, it doesn't apply to anything else. They were here solely because of Whirlpool. And I think that the conversion to find new customers and it's a very limited use product. And it's, like I said, it was designed and built for Whirlpool.
Now, these next two words I'm going to say are, you know, just I say them because they're ratings gold. Bond refinancing.
Yes. Well, you hope they're ratings gold. Speaking of ratings, thankfully, the city of Fort Smith, although some people want to allege that the city finances are out of control, apparently they're not, and the markets, which sometimes can be one of the best arbiters, bought the bonds, 2% interest rates, down from a 4% interest rate on bonds that were outstanding, And the city estimates it saved a little over $1 million, about $1.1 million. And these, of course, Tyler, helped continue work on the water and sewer system projects in Fort Smith. And, you know, Fort Smith has been under an EPA order, Department of Justice order, to get its act together in terms of its water and sewer system. And so this continues to help do that. But as, you know, if anyone's refinanced a home lately, it's the same concept, you know. And then we'll have a little later this year in March 13th, we'll have a vote. The citizens will get to vote on another extension for bonds that will help help further the work on the water and sewer systems, and could even build an aquatics park and ball fields at Ben Guerin Regional Park here in Sebastian County.
The economic slump has had its effect on post offices and postal centers, many closed, many up for closure. Now comes word from the Army Corps of Engineers that tight budgeting will mean some changes in state parks.
Yes, they're going to, you know, propose, and this had been expected, you know, they're going to close some campgrounds and parks or reduce how much of the parks they kept open. But I was surprised, Kyle, that it was 29 parks in the state. I mean, they 10 boat ramps, 13 campgrounds. I mean, it's an interesting list. Of course, you know, obviously I'd encourage folks to come to the CityWire and look at some details about Northwest Arkansas and Fort Smith area, and then there's a link to the rest of the list from the Corps. But, you know, it is a bittersweet pill. You know, it's funny how we Americans are. We talk about government has to get its house in order and cut its finances and make its budgets balance. And then sometimes when they start doing that and cutting campsites, we think, oh, wait, we didn't mean like that, you know. So,
right.
And, you know, Senator Pryor sent out a statement yesterday in which, you know, he somewhat said that, you know, as we reduce government spending, you know, we have to make sure that, you know, we know we're going to have to prioritize and make tough budget decisions. And I'm somewhat paraphrasing what he's saying, but it's kind of a bittersweet pill. You hate to see those kind of opportunities go, but at the same time, you know that they're trying to balance budgets. So maybe that's a good thing. It'll be interesting to see what kind of feedback they get. The Corps says these are parks and these are campgrounds that are very, you know, they're not used
as much. Yeah.
So, but we'll see if that's the case.
Finally, on the CityWire, you have reaction from Arkansans to the decision by the president to approve construction of the Keystone Pipeline. You make the point that members of both parties in this state seem disappointed, at least initially.
Right. Well, you know, President Obama is saying that he didn't reject the construction based on the merits of the deal. He is. I think the Republicans in Congress and the president are playing a little political game here. Congress set a February 21st deadline. The president said that was arbitrary. It wasn't enough time to conduct what he called a full environmental assessment. Obviously, Republicans disagree. They say there's been more than enough environmental work on it. But the facts of the pipeline are is that it indeed will connect a lot of the oil sands, the oil production in Canada, with the U.S., and it'll connect that oil to the refinery region, which is Texas, Louisiana, and would have almost immediately, once they got it going, a not insignificant impact on the amount of oil we have to import from overseas. So on one hand, I understand President Obama's wanting to be a little careful with the environment. I mean, you don't want to have a big oil leak, you know, running through the plains of Kansas. But at the same time, the alternative is to ship a lot of oil across the oceans, you know, through these tankers. And I just have to wonder which is going to be safer. But anyway, yeah, both Pryor and Ross are both Democrats, Senator Pryor and Congressman Ross, in no uncertain words. They didn't mix words. They said that Obama made a wrong decision. They're disappointed, and they're going to do everything they can to get it reversed.
I know some people have speculated what this might mean for the president's numbers in Arkansas, but that seems somewhat irrelevant. Other than possibly Oklahoma and Utah, this seems to be the state least likely to tilt in the president's reelection favor.
Right. I mean, yeah, the latest polls, I think, had Obama maybe capturing 35-34% of the vote in Arkansas. I mean, you raise the question, could it get any worse for him in Arkansas? But Yes, there will be some key states, some of those key Midwestern states. And we got to remember South Dakota and a few other states in the country, and even maybe in South Arkansas, the old oil areas around El Dorado. I mean, oil production could become much more significant in the U.S., and if we have a pipeline that we can start building infrastructure around, that could, again, that could get us to that goal that we've talked about since the 70s of energy independence.
Michael Tilley is the editor, publisher, president of thecitywire.com. Michael, as always, thank you for your time.
All right. You're welcome, Colin. Have a good weekend.
You too. It's Thursday, January 19th, 2012. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Iti Agnihotri Madhulkar.
With us, Becca Bacon-Martin. She's features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Spring will happen. You know how I know?
How?
Because the lists of things to do are already gearing up. So there is hope, and I got my first press release from Silver Dollar City. I'm happy. Today, if you want to go out and do something and not wait for spring, there's a gallery tour called Greatest Hits at Crystal Bridges at 2:30. They have a new adult story hour at the Bella Vista Library. It starts at 3 o'clock, and this week's story is An End to Dreams by Stephen Vincent Benet.
So an adult story hour. So
somebody reads
what's
a story.
An adult story?
Oh. Like, well, it's
is
not,
it an adult story, or is it, you know, story,
a story hour
for
adults?
Okay.
Yeah.
So somebody, just like little kids, somebody reads you a story.
I think
it sounds lovely.
That's nice.
Kind of like radio.
Yeah, kind of like radio. Mm-hmm. Maybe they'll let us go do that. Mm. That'd be fun. 3 o'clock is teen time at the Boone County Library in Harrison. They'll be playing Wii games. Teen Gamers Club at 6 o'clock at the Rogers Public Library. And tonight, the Railway Historical Society meets at 7 o'clock at the General Store at the Shiloh Museum in Springdale. Also tonight, in the River Valley, country musician Eric Church is at the Fort Smith Convention Center. He had a number one album last year and a Grammy nomination. And I don't remember the exact title of his tour, except it has something to do with beer.
All right.
Opening acts, Brantley Gilbert. Tickets start at $29.50 at Ticketmaster.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Bacon-Martin is the features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Ozarks at Large. Mention the word dog patch to a native Arkansan or almost any native Southerner, and you'll likely get a wince. The fictional home for little Abner, Daisy May, and the other characters created by Al Capp is a standard for referring to a backwoods village inhabited by barefoot, moonshine-drinking lazy men and the women who tolerate them. The comic strip Little Abner was more complicated than that, but the stereotypes Capp used to tell his satirical stories of government, society, and culture are all too familiar to Southerners.
And that's the one that sort of dogged Arkansas and the Arkansas Ozarks in particular for a long time.
Gabe Land, the director of the Rogers Historical Museum, says the hillbilly image is addressed in a new exhibit at the museum exploring the depiction of the South in comic strips.
But as you go through the exhibit, they point out some ways in which the stereotypes were not all negative. And in fact, there's an interactive part of the exhibit where they ask visitors to think about examples of positive stereotypes and negative ones, and to chart those out using Post-it notes. And I've seen that a lot of our visitors have been doing that. There's definitely more negatives than positives, but there are some positives. For example, good food, as you know, people associate particular certain types of foods with the South, or the idea that Southerners are closer to and more appreciative of nature.
The exhibit examines not just the comic strips like Little Abner and Fred Laswell's Snuffy Smith, but more contemporary work like Kudzu, a strip based in North Carolina that was created by the late Pulitzer Prize winner Doug Marlette. It takes a more nuanced view of life in the South. There are also several reproductions of Walt Kelly's beloved Pogo. The idea, Gabe Land says, is to stimulate conversation about how a popular medium broached the subject of the South. One panel invites patrons to discuss what is a stereotype.
the exhibit comes from a museum about the development of the New South, the development of the South in the late 1800s and through the 20th century and up to the modern period. And so they're focusing on Southern stereotypes, but one of the purposes of the exhibit and some of the educational materials that they used along with it was simply to encourage visitors, including school children, to think about what a stereotype is and how they're developed and what stereotypes do you have about other people that may not necessarily have anything to do with the region of the country they come from, but just to delve a little bit into that subject in general.
By showing blown-up, colorful reproductions of past strips that ran in newspapers over several decades, the exhibit allows visitors to see a few trends. In the strips of the 30s, 40s, 50s, and into the 1960s, the rural Southern man is frequently near his moonshine still or jug, and the rural Southern woman falls into one of two types, clueless bombshell or hard-working matriarch.
Between the innocent Southern beauty, Little Abner's cartoonist Al Capp also created Long Sam, which was another comic strip in the late 50s into the early 60s. And she's a very naive girl who talks to the birds and butterflies. And she was actually the prototype for the character of Ellie Mae on the Beverly Hillbillies TV show. And then you have, the image of women who are working like men while the men folk are laying around. From Little Abner, there's the man there asleep under the tree, and there's the woman there washing, and she's got a sign in front, "Washing Took In," to raise some extra money for the family.
The exhibit also looks at how race in Southern-themed strips, comic books, and cartoons has been portrayed, especially when drawn or written by non-Southerners, like Al Capp or Fred Laswell. The exhibit will be at the Rogers Historical Museum through March 24th. There is an accompanying film series as well, consisting of Hollywood representations of the South from Lum and Abner to Deliverance. You can see those films each Saturday afternoon beginning at 1 o'clock at the Rogers Public Library. The films, including this week's showing of Jezebel, are free and open to the public. And there is another Rogers Historical Museum exhibit out there that's worth mentioning. It's a bit different. It tells the story of how an Arkansan shook stereotypes. Right now at the Bentonville Public Library is a display about Bentonville native Louise Thaden. She was a pioneer in aviation, business, and more. Again, Gabe Land, director of the Rogers Historical Museum.
Something that's interesting is that Louise was aware of some of the negative images about Arkansas and the Ozarks, and talked a little bit about that in some of her interviews, and said that, "I always make a point whenever I give an interview to say that I'm from Bentonville, Arkansas, because I'm proud of my roots and I'm proud of where I'm from." So we do have a little tie-in there. But, yes, she was an amazing woman, a real pioneer in aviation, a record holder, won a number of prestigious races. And several years ago, we had a larger exhibit here at the museum about her, but this is one of our community exhibits. It's four panels with photographs and some quotations from her and a text to go along with it and some scans of some interesting documents that we thought is brand new and that it ought to debut in her hometown of Bentonville. So it's at the Bentonville Public Library now. And then at the end of this month, we'll be pulling it in. It's going to go into our regular rotation and go around all of our Rogers venues.
The Louise Thaden exhibit is on display right now at the Bentonville Public Library. For more information, bentonvillelibrary.org. Museums design their displays to foster conversation. A Fort Smith museum, the Clayton House, is beginning a new monthly series this weekend devoted to conversation. The Clayton Conversations will connect the historic house museum on 6th Street, the city's history, and the city's present. Julie Moncrief is the executive director of the Clayton House. The Clayton House is the former home of a legendary district attorney who served during the term of Judge Isaac Parker. Julie Moncrief says this conversation series will continue an oral tradition inside the house. The rooms where the Claytons ate, entertained, and relaxed were, you could say, the original chat rooms.
There definitely was not television. It was discussion and social times. This house definitely had you know, a huge number of social events. We're sitting in this dining room that no doubt entertained dignitaries from across the state, but you toured the home and you went to the formal parlor where a wedding was held of important folks here in Fort Smith. And so, yes, people to people was definitely something that took place in the 1800s, late 1800s.
The first Clayton Conversation is Sunday afternoon at 2:30. It will feature Dr. Taylor Pruitt discussing medical care during Fort Smith's past. Future conversations will center on the arrival of electricity to the city, Fort Smith's role as a one-time furniture manufacturing capital, and more. Julie Moncrief says inspiration for the series was born, partly, out of the need of the Clayton House to be an active participant in the community and bring visitors inside the door. But she says she also learned the value of community discussion while directing a Fort Smith leadership program.
And I really do see the excitement of helping our own citizens meet other citizens here and learn from them. There's so many people that have so much to offer, and sometimes it's amazing that people can be best kept secrets with their great knowledge.
Julie Moncrief volunteered with the Bass Reeves Legacy Initiative as well. That was an effort to raise money for this year's unveiling of a statue of the one-time U.S. Marshal, so pivotal in Fort Smith's history. Part of the final push to the finish line for that work was a massive education process explaining who Bass Reeves was. Julie says she saw then that history matters to the city's residents, and she says she thinks the Clayton Conversations will matter as well.
When the Claytons lived in this house from 1882 to 1897, that was a boom period for Fort Smith. So many things happened during that period. You know, from 1880 to 1885, the population tripled, and then it kept growing from there. And, you know, we've got electricity, and we got gas lighting, and courthouses built, and industries began, like our furniture industry that we were so well known for. And there are a lot of people that know specific histories about these areas. And so I thought it would be fun to share with everybody the juicy, good, fun details that make you actually enjoy learning from these citizens about these specific topics.
The first Clayton Conversation is Sunday afternoon at 2:30 at the Clayton House at 514 North 6th Street in Fort Smith, and will feature Dr. Taylor Pruitt. The event is free and open to the public. The series will continue each fourth Sunday. For more information, you can go to claytonhouse.org.
College classes are back in session following the holidays. The Art Gallery on the University of Arkansas campus is welcoming the spring semester with its first show. And Ozarks at Largest Katie Hendrickson has this preview.
There's a new exhibit up in the Fine Arts Gallery on the University of Arkansas campus in Fayetteville. Non-Equilibrium features artist Carol Pruce's three-dimensional dome-shaped drawings. After 9/11, she decided to become, in her own words, a conceptual voyager. She also muted her palette. She works now in grays and silvers. Exploring interconnectedness between the body and the cosmos, the work looks at once inward and out. With allusions to the inner workings of the human via organ-like patterns, think intestines or the womb, and stretching out to the cosmos via star-like pinholes subtly lit from the inside of the half-spheres, recalling an inverse planetarium or perhaps a painted cathedral dome. Prusa was first trained as a medical illustrator, and the intricacy and technical expertise shows through. Some of these domes have taken up to 700 hours to complete. Sam King, interim director of the Fine Arts Gallery, elaborates on Prusa's work.
Prusa's work seems to balance things that seem like they might be at odds with each other in some ways, or at opposite ends of a spectrum. In some senses, they evoke what might be like the cosmic or the vast, but then in terms of their actual scale, they're more kind of human size. Like you could stretch your arms out and your arm span would contain the work. Most of the work is circular, or at least not rectilinear. Like even the works that could be argued to be rectangles are softened at the corners. So she isn't engaged with the kind of picture making maybe that you think of in a traditional sense, like it has to be inside of a rectangle. The forms do have an organic, they have an organic quality, but also a very ordered quality. There's a definite structure that emerges in every work, and it's also interesting to me that so much of it seems like a narrow field that she's working inside of, but each piece is very distinctive. You know, there's a very limited palette at work. It's all grays, whites, and just occasional notes of color. But even inside of the limited palette and working inside of a similar array of media every time, there's actually quite a few media involved in the making of the work. There's a definite character to each piece, and it's nice that they emerge as you study them. Like as you engage each work, they kind of unfold, and they kind of envelop you, actually, even despite that it's kind of like a, what I would think of as being like a middle scale. Like they're not tiny, they're not precious, but they're not massive or imposing. They're sort of human size. Even with that scale considered, you are given occasion to think of things on a much larger scale and a much smaller scale. Like you're seeing seeing something magnified, or you're seeing something brought down to your size or something. It's interesting.
There are these orbs that are actually mounted attached to the wall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the orbs are they're sort of dome shaped, and they're different dimensions. Some of them are more kind of bulbous, and then some of them are more like a shallow kind of dome shape. But they're mounted to the wall. They're shaped plastic, and then the plastic is then she paints on top and draws on top of them, but she also will puncture places in them, in some of them at least, and install like fiber optic lighting, which is a surprisingly subtle thing. Like some of them, you could be looking at them for a little bit before you even notice that they're there, which is kind of, it's really impressive in a way, because you would think it would be hard to use it without it becoming the main thing, but it's just one of many elements. Also think it's kind of nice that her work combines things that are very contemporary in terms of a medium. I mean, fiber optics wasn't an option even, you know, I don't know, like 50 years ago or something. I could be wrong about that. But then she's alternating that with something like Silver Point, which is like what Albrecht Dürer drew his self-portrait in, you know, when he wasn't engraving or etching.
The artist will be in Fayetteville for a reception and lecture at 5:30 p.m. on January 26th. It's free and open to the public. KUAF will interview her while she's in town. The exhibit, Non-Equilibrium, is up until February 17th at the Fine Arts Gallery on the University of Arkansas campus in Fayetteville. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Katie Henriksen.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellens. With me is Jody Beznoska, Vice President for Communications at Walton Arts Center. How are you doing?
I'm good. We're busy.
Yeah, you are.
We're busy. We're having fun, though. Let's just get right started. So tomorrow evening, we will have the Pancho Sanchez Band and mm-hmm. his group. They will be here at 8 o'clock. Their show is on the 10x10 art series, which means that the tickets for the show are only $10. I've learned that some people are a little confused about the 10x10 series, and they sometimes think you have to buy all 10 to get this $10 price. And I want to say, no, that is not correct. You can just come to any show on the 10x10 art series, and they're only $10 a piece, the tickets. So that show is Friday night. That's an 8 o'clock performance. There's a 7 p.m. countdown, creative conversation prior to the show. Robert Ginsberg will be facilitating that, and we believe that Pancho and another member of his band will be in that conversation.
That'll be a lot of fun.
Free and open to anyone who has a ticket to the show. So just come at 7 o'clock, and you'll get a chance to hear from him directly. Mm-hmm. Then on Saturday, we have the Symphony of Northwest Arkansas's third concert of the season. It's their second Masterworks concert. That's a 7:30 performance with a 6:45 countdown creative conversation. And this one will be facilitated by yours truly,
yes.
Right? Or
yeah.
You, not
yes.
me.
Paul Haas and I will mm-hmm. talk about Rachmaninoff,
mm-hmm.
preparing for the Masterworks and such. That's at 6:45 in Star.
Show. Correct. And the show is at 7:30.
Right.
So there's two pieces on the official program, the Rachmaninoff 3, known as the Rock 3, and the Shostakovich Symphony No. 5, both monumental, huge, sweeping, emotional mm-hmm. symphonic works. I'm pretty excited to hear these. I don't think that I ever have, and this is the kind of music that if you just sit there and let it take you away. It will take you somewhere. Mm-hmm. Don't know where it will take you, but it will take you. So it's going to be a pretty remarkable concert, I think, very big in scale. And, of course, it's Paul Haas, so he's probably got a surprise tucked in there somewhere. Mm-hmm. So that's always fun. That's Saturday, 7:30, with a creative conversation at 6:45. Then Sunday, we will have a free event at the Fayetteville Public Library. This is a countdown conversation.
Yes, there are the countdown conversations that are creative conversations.
It's a little bit confusing. Yes. But this is a 2 p.m. event in the Walker Community Room at the Public Library in Fayetteville. And I'm really looking forward to this one. These countdown conversations are meant to help us get a little more depth into the 10x10 artists and art forms. And so for this one, we will have you speaking to Jenny Taylor Swain, who is our Vice President of Programs at Walton Arts Center. And I think one of the people who has sort of driven the development of the dance audience here, she has really worked hard to bring dance companies here that we would never see normally. And so the Mark Morris Company is an amazing company that we get to see for only $10.
Right.
So she'll talk about that. The neat thing about the Mark Morris Company is that they play to live music, which is always fantastic. Mm-hmm. And then Bob Ford, who is, you know, obviously well-known locally as a playwright and a professor, is also a musician.
Yeah, and not just a casual musician.
Yeah, quite a good one, plays with Sona and many other organizations. And he will be there to sort of help us gain context into Time for Three, which is a trio that will be on the 10x10 series as well. So I think that's going to be a really fun conversation. That's at 2 p.m. on Sunday, the 22nd, at the Fayetteville Public Library, and that is free and open to anyone. And then a couple days off, and we will have Keb Moe here on Wednesday the 25th, a 7 o'clock show. Keb Moe is always a favorite.
Right.
Everyone, you know, this town really loves him, and I think he's going to give a great show with his band. And then on the 28th, we have Lewis Black. That's an 8 o'clock show. He's a comedian that many will know from Comedy Central. As of right now, that show is at capacity, and we don't have tickets available. But what we tell people is you can come down an hour prior and get on the standby list, and we'll try to get you in. That's an 8 o'clock show. Then we will have the two shows we were just speaking of. We will have Mark Morris on the 2nd. That's a Thursday. That's the Mark Morris Dance Group. They'll be performing their sort of really well-known piece called Grand Duo. And then they also will be doing a piece called Festival Dance, which just premiered in 2011. All of that to live music, which is a very unique and wonderful way to experience dance. At 7 p.m. with a 6 p.m. creative conversation prior to the show. We'll probably have a dancer from the company or maybe their company manager there to talk to us about the process of being a touring dance company. Then on the 3rd, we will have Time for Three. This is the trio we talked about, two violins and a bass. They are classically trained, but they play every style of music you could possibly imagine. And they are really, really cool, interesting young guys who are trying to bring classical music to more people. They're really fun. That's a 8 p.m. show on Friday the 3rd of February. There will be a 7 p.m. creative conversation, and we're understanding that the trio will be there, and they will be the creative conversation prior. So that's Friday the 3rd. Saturday the 4th, we will change gears, and we will go to Intergalactic Nemesis at 8 p.m.
Recently on All Things Considered.
Yes, yes. Mm. And I think beginning to become a phenomenon in terms of, you know, gaining awareness and gaining traction. The best way, I think, to describe Intergalactic Nemesis is it's a comic book come to life. We've been saying live-action graphic novel, which is true, but it's comic book theater. Mm-hmm. So you will see comic book-like images being flashed up on the screen, but there are Foley artists on stage making sounds.
Really?
Yes. And so it's really, it's a very, very cool, very, very cool concept, and it's different than anything we've ever seen here at the Arts Center before. So it's basically a play that has been developed based on this sort of modern comic book.
Right.
Super fun. And I think definitely going to be an interesting thing for anybody who loves comic books, but also just if you consider yourself sort of a aficionado of how art, how theater is changing, I would come see this because this could be a really really interesting night.
It's one day?
One night only.
You only got one chance.
Only
okay.
One chance, yeah. And I actually just learned that the show is playing at the New Victory Theater on Broadway. Hmm. So it's definitely rising up in terms of popularity. So that's the 4th. That's a Saturday. That's an 8 o'clock show. And then after that, we will have a week of Bring It On, the musical, from the 7th of February through the 12th. This is a live Broadway-style musical that features, you know, standard Broadway singing, but also competitive cheerleading. And really, really high energy, really interesting and fun, creative new show that has not been to Broadway yet. It's touring the country first, but we're all assuming that it will find its way to the Great White Way at some point. So that's from the 7th to the 12th. Theater Squared in the middle of that will launch their next show, Tigers Be Still. That will start on the 9th of February and run through the 26th. That's a very funny, very funny comedy. I'm sure we'll talk more about that as time goes on. And then we will into the middle of February. We will have Ms. Loretta Lynn. And
cannot
I know
wait.
On the 16th. That's a Thursday. That's a should be a 7 o'clock show. She's a legend. She mm-hmm. is Loretta Lynn. Can't wait to hear her in our hall. I think that's going to be very, very exciting. But this musical sort of imagines what might have happened while that recording was being made. Really, really wonderful.
Yeah, looking forward to all of this.
There's all kinds of stuff going on. And I also want to give a little shout out to a slightly unknown group that works behind the scenes at Walton Arts Center. We have an event coming up on February 19th. It's called the Masquerade Ball. Mm-hmm. It's a fundraiser. The whole Walton Arts Center is transformed into a Mardi Gras party. It's a masked ball where people show up in black tie with a mask. And the whole point of the event is to fundraise for our arts education programs. But it's put on by a group called the Corporate Leadership Council at Walton Arts Center. And these are leaders from all over the community, in the business community, who have basically committed to be on this council with us to actively raise money to help us fund our arts education programs. There are a few tickets left to the Masquerade Ball, not many.
Oh.
So if anyone's interested, they can call the box office. But it's on the 19th. It's a big party, and it raises a huge amount of money for us. So we wanted to say thanks to all of those who are corporate leaders on our council, because it's going to be a really good night, and hopefully it will help us bring more kids to the Arts Center.
So if you want to know about the Masquerade Party or anything else we've talked about,
you can go to waltonartscenter.org, or you can call our box office at 443-5600, or you can come down and visit us. You can just park in the lot across the street. It's free until 2 o'clock. Come in and say hello to our friendly box office representatives.
Thanks, Jody.
Thank you.
This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Ithi Agnihotri Vidholkar.
I'm Kyle Kellums.
And it's time for a question now.
That's right. We'll give away a couple of tickets to an Area Malco movie theater.
And the question is right in front of me, but I cannot make any sense of it.
Well, and that's to be understood, and I'll tell you why. Earlier, talking about Rogers Historical Museum, their current exhibit, which includes the comic strips Little Abner.
Mm-hmm.
This is a question relating to Little Abner, a comic strip that was popular in the United States in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Okay.
So I don't think it translated in it. Okay.
No.
So which Little Abner character is described thusly? Plump bowling pin with legs. It has smooth skin, eyebrows, and sparse whiskers, but no arms, nose, or ears.
We can call us up at 1-800-522-5823. That's 1-800-522-KUAF.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 19th of January, 2012. Today is the day that snow fell on Miami in 1977. Two Arctic fronts slammed into Florida. Flakes started falling in the pre-dawn hours. School children ran out to try to catch the flakes on their tongues. The cold weather decimated the citrus and vegetable crops, and 150,000 migrant farm workers lost their jobs. Tampa got more than 0.2 inches. The city came to a standstill. It's the birthday of Edgar Allan Poe, born in Boston, 1809, parents, actors, father left the family a year later, mother died of tuberculosis a year after that, the boy raised by a family in Richmond, Virginia, who sent him to the University of Virginia, where he did a certain amount of drinking and gambling, which led to a falling out with his foster father, and Poe was disowned. Spent the next several years in poverty trying to support himself, writing anything he could. He first made his name writing book reviews, and he was a brutal book reviewer. People called him the Tomahawk Man. Writing did not pay well back then, and in 1842 his young wife Virginia contracted tuberculosis, and his work became darker and more grotesque, and he wrote some of his best-known macabre stories and poems. He wrote The Telltale Heart in 1843 and then The Raven in 1845. Though it was a big success, he only got $9 for the poem. His wife died in 1847. Poe died 2 years later, found delirious in the gutter in Baltimore. Cause of death was never determined, but most people assumed it had to do with his alcoholism or drug addiction. But many of the assumptions people have long held about Edgar Allan Poe can be traced back to one of his rivals, Rufus Wilmot Griswold. Poe had written a very sharp review of one of Griswold's books, and Griswold got revenge by writing Poe's obituary for the New York Tribune. And he became Poe's literary executor and wrote a memoir of the author in which he portrayed Poe as a drug addict, a drunk, a madman. We know now that Poe did suffer bouts of depression, that he had a complicated relationship with alcohol, did some binge drinking followed by long periods of abstinence. But his reputation as a drunk and a madman can be traced back to the fact that he was a hard-edged reviewer of other people's work, and his enemies were quick to spread demeaning stories about him. Here's a poem by Edgar Allan Poe on his birthday, A Dream Within a Dream. Take this kiss upon the brow, and in parting from you now, thus much let me avow. You are not wrong who deem that my days have been a dream. Yet if hope has flown away in a night or in a day, in a vision or in none, is it therefore the less gone? All that we see or seem is but a dream within a dream. I stand amid the roar of a surf-tormented shore, and I hold within my hand grains of the golden sand. How few, yet how they creep through my fingers to the deep, while I weep. Oh God, can I not grasp them with a tighter clasp? Oh God, can I not save one from the pitiless wave? Is all that we see or seem but a dream within a dream? A poem by Edgar Allan Poe. The Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation. You can turn your iPhone or Android into a virtual poetry library with the Poetry Foundation's poetry app, available to everyone online at poetryfoundation.org. Produced by Kathy Roach and Nick Vetter. Be well, do good work. Keep in touch.
Time to answer our question. Before we answer today's question, congratulations to Valerie Sawyer of Fayetteville, who won yesterday's question about the butterfly in Baltimore.
And the answer?
Today? Mm-hmm. Well, first let me rephrase the question or restate the question. What little Abner character is described as a plump bowling pin with legs? It has smooth skin, eyebrows, and sparse whiskers, but no arms, nose, or ears.
And the answer is?
Do you have a guess?
No.
The answer, as anyone who either read Little Abner or, if you're around my age and you went to the amusement park dog patch near Jasper in the 70s or 80s, everyone knows it's a shmoo.
What?
A shmoo. I'll show you a picture of a shmoo here in a minute.
Okay.
Little sort of amoeba-looking-like cartoon character.
Okay.
Everyone who answered shmoo, your name goes in the ceramic cow. One correct answer will come out. You'll win two tickets to an area Malco movie theater.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Springdale, Rogers, Prairie Grove.
Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Ithi Agnihotri Matholkar.
You and I back together on Sunday for Weekend Ozarks at Large.
I'll be back on Monday.
Right. Christina Thomas will join me tomorrow for a brand new edition at noon.
Mm-hmm. She will.
Yes, she will. Okay. Have a very pleasant Thursday.